One, continuing our interview with Dr. Lipetz. So you were meeting German Jews at the synagogue in Manila?
At the synagogue in Manila and becoming quite active. I remember we went on a Sunday school picnic. I remember going to Shabbos services, going to Friday night. I remember that the cantor's name, because we got to know him very well, and it was Joseph Cisner, C-Y-S-N-E-R. I wonder what ever happened to him. He's a young man. And then when the war broke out, Manila fell, and life came to a relatively quickly to some kind of a normal, or not a normal, is not the right word, a...
Equilibrium
of some sort. Mm-hmm. And I remember still going to synagogue, and I can remember a number of incidents. I'll tell you two. One of which was somebody was being followed. One of the members of the synagogue was being followed by the Japanese secret police for some reason. And I don't know whether they had a reason to or not. And I imagine they thought they had a reason. Mm-hmm. And we were in this Friday evening services, and we were in the synagogue, which was a Moorish-style building. It looked like somebody's idea of what a synagogue must have looked like in ancient Israel. It was yellow. And we were in the sanctuary, and this Japanese man comes in, and obviously, you know, he stood out very quickly. And he was very, very, very nice about it. He walked in and he saw everybody else was wearing a yarmulke or a kippah, and he went over and got one. He put one on and sat unobtrusively in the back and got up and sat down as the rest of us did. And what? Now, the story was he was following somebody. Whether it was that or just curiosity, I don't know. A lot of the Japanese expressed some important, educated ones, a lot of interest in what was going on and who we were.
Did you pick up the Japanese?
Yes. Well, let me tell you about that. Mm. We were enrolled in school, and the only school we could be enrolled in, for whatever reason, was a private school, which was run by the Christian Brothers, the same people who run LaSalle College here.
Uh-huh.
And it was called LaSalle High School, and the Japanese authorities decreed that we had to learn Japanese. So, watashi wa nippon wo hanashi desu. I learned to read and write some Japanese. Not a whole lot, but enough to get by.
Amazing.
And we also had to learn Tagalog, because it was which is the native language for, which one of the languages in the Philippines. There are something like 6,000 languages. It's a very, there's a lot of islands. The Philippine archipelago has more islands in it than any other archipelago in the world, or something like that. Anyway, Tagalog I never mastered, except a few words which I will not repeat. But Japanese I got some hang of, which we probably have forgotten most of.
Who were the other children in the school?
Mostly Filipino. As a matter of fact, one of the people I went to school with was the late President Aquino. Her husband was a classmate of mine, and a few of the other names that you see, look if I remember, were in my class.
Were there any other European children?
A few of the German Jews were there.
Children.
And this is where I first really encountered firsthand anti-Semitism. I remember being beaten up on more than one occasion.
On the part of native Filipinos?
Native for better, but these were educated, but these people came from wealthy families. I mean, this was a private school, yeah. Being beaten up for having done something which I couldn't quite understand, but it's something with crucifying somebody named Jesus. And I didn't know what crucifixion was, and I certainly didn't know who Jesus was. Mm-hmm. But I had done it, and I don't remember ever having done it. And, you know, why didn't I convert, and what was wrong with me? And I remember a lot I would hate to go to school. I was... beaten up regularly for some, we were forced to study catechism, or to sit in the class. We didn't have to study. The Jewish students did not have to learn the catechism, but we had to sit in the class and be exposed to it.
Didn't the Japanese intervene?
No.
You to learn their...
Well, we had to learn...
Religious philosophy?
No, not their religious. As far as religion was concerned, the Japanese were very tolerant or not interested. I don't know.
This was a tuition.
It was an expensive school, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the better private schools. And well, the Christian Brothers always did run a very good educational sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And my parents put a high price on education. And
your brothers went to the school too?
Leon went. Eric was too young.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also met several times a week, because he lived nearby, with the cantor, mm-hmm. and Joseph Sissner,
mm-hmm.
where I would study Hebrew and Chumash with him.
Mm-hmm.
And we studied the Chumash, and I never forget, we even did a little bit of Rashi, because I was getting bored with Chumash, and he said, okay, let me show you what comes next.
Uh-huh.
And I can even tell you what in Rashi we studied. I remember that distinctly.
Oh, yeah.
It was the passage in Genesis and Bereishit where the brothers decide that they're going to get rid of Joseph, and they throw him in the well. And in the Chumash it says that the well was empty and there was nothing in the well.
Mm-hmm.
And Rashi asked the question, why is it written that the well is empty and there is nothing in it? If it's empty, obviously there is nothing in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Rashi says this is to indicate that not only was there no water, which you might expect in the well,
right.
but there were no poisonous animals, spiders or whatever in there that would have hurt Joseph. And I remember being struck. God, this is incredible stuff.
This was God's providential hand, of course.
Yes, but also I thought this was wonderful, you know, that you could not just study Chumash, but you could study Chumash about Chumash, and you could go on and build. I thought it was very, very interesting. It was really turned on to a lot of that.
That's interesting. You were now, what, 11 or so?
I was about 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned the word intervention. The Japanese ever intervene. Well, this is one of the stories, I guess, which, you know, out of every horrible moment in history, there are some moments of humor. Sometimes it's black humor, but it's humor. We lived on a street in Manila for a while. It was a very nice street, Calimabini. And my brother, my youngest brother, Eric, who at that time must have been around 5, 6, had a scooter. And this scooter was constructed out of a roller skate and 2 boards.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved to skate up and down the street.
On the scooter. And the scooter was very noisy and trashy.
But further down the street was a German family, but a German family, that who used to fly the swastika. They were very pro-Nazi. And there were a lot of Nazis in there, too. There was a large German colony.
German.
And, One afternoon, Eric was riding his scooter and making noise, and the Germans were trying to take their siesta, so they came out and they knocked my brother off his scooter and took the scooter away.
Mm.
And my brother was in tears, and he's walking down the street trying to get a heart out.
Mm-hmm.
And the apartment house next to ours had become a Japanese military billet. And the Japanese soldiers looked at him and asked him what was wrong. Why was he crying? They were very kind to children. Very kind. They really took a real love to children.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you another story about that, too. Anyway, Eric somehow, in a mixture of English and French and God knows what, told the soldiers what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldiers got really annoyed. So it happened, one of the soldiers was a non-commissioned officer. He called out his troops. 4 or 5 men with rifles and fixed bayonets.
Oh my.
They marched to this person's house, knocked on the door, and essentially said, do you have this kid's scooter?
Oh my word.
And the Germans tried all kinds of words, the Nazis and the fourth, and give the kid a scooter. So they gave Eric his scooter.
Oh my.
And wait, this gets better. And then they go out and they stand in the street there with their guns with fixed bayonets. And these are big guns, big bayonets. When you're a little kid, they're even bigger. And they say to Eric, ride up and down on the street.
Oh, that's a choice story.
So,
there was one very happy little boy
was,
in Manila.
Yeah, there was, and the name we still remember, the name of the Japanese non-commissioned officer was a Corporal Muna.
How would you spell that?
I would guess it would be M-O-O-N-A. He was Eric's friend. And there was never any trouble from that quarter again.
Excuse me, I must ask this. Did the Germans know that you were Jewish?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But they tried very hard, apparently, to instigate the Japanese against the Jews.
Yes.
And the Japanese would have none of it. They had no use for the Germans either. The Japanese were into, they just didn't like white people. They didn't care what your religion was. It was your skin color that mattered.
We understand that in Shanghai, too, the Germans tried to get them to introduce the Jewish star, and even beyond that to the dancing installations. Nothing like that ever happened.
It was unknown. I mean, I did not ever detect any kind of anti-Semitism. I mean, anti-white, yes, but anti-European, but not anti-Jewish. I never, never even thought. And let me tell you another story. Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, and I don't remember which, but it was one of the high holidays, 1942, maybe 43, I think it was 42. It's going to be a hard one.
Joy, stop it.
No. It was during the service, and the place was packed, as synagogues often are on high holidays. And we were all facing the Bima, of course, and this was the point where the Torah was taken out of the ark, and the cantor holds the Torah in his arms, and he turns to face the congregation, and at the same time he's facing the back door. And he had a very good voice, and his voice began to crack, and he couldn't know what was going on, and we turned around to look. The Japanese had brought the civilian Jewish internees from Santa Tomas camp, under armed guard, but brought them to the synagogue for services. And here were these people, gaunt, hungry. Clothes were bedraggled. The conditions were not great in the camps. They were not terrible yet, but they were not great to join us for a service.
Which is a really quite remarkable phenomenon to have released the prisoners.
We're talking about a fairly large number of people. You know,
these were
Americans,
American,
British, Dutch.
Prisoners of war. Jewish
not, not prisoners of war. They were civilian internees.
Civilian internees.
Not soldiers. They were civilians.
And on what basis were they interned?
All
at war.
If all nationals of countries at war with Japan were interned.
Were you able to? Were your parents able to socialize with these people?
I don't remember. I don't remember anything other than that incident.
Were there any children among them?
I don't think so. I don't remember.
But they looked emaciated.
They looked very sad, Jay. Although at that time things weren't that bad there yet. You need to remember that the Japanese at first did not treat civilian internees any differently than they treated their own soldiers. But they didn't treat their own soldiers that well. You know, they had the standards of care and compassion were very different.
But their treatment of prisoners of war was pretty ghastly.
It was pretty ghastly, but again, it's ghastly to our eyes. In their eyes, they were not really that much worse than the way they treated their own prisoners. Their standards were very different. The whole ethical Weltanschauung is different. Or was, I suspect, right now. It's, you know, Japan has come a long way in the last 40 years.
So these internees were allowed to stay for the service,
for
and
the
then,
service
of course, returned.
And I thought that was a... You know, you asked, were they like the Germans? And there was a very large... Now, one of our neighbors in the apartment house was a German, a real German. He was not a Nazi. He was a Baron somebody, rather. Mm-hmm. The only member of the nobility I ever had the grace to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very anti-Nazi, we found out later. He was heartbroken that this happened. He was one of these old German families, and he thought Hitler was some punk upstart. So what was he doing to German Kultur? So forth.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful man, Count Gronke, Kurt Gronke, G-R-O-N-K-E.
Haven't thought about him for a while.
He was a single man, he was an older man, he had a great dame, who I loved to, I could ride on his back. And he had air conditioning.
air conditioned.
And on occasion, I would be invited to stay with his
vacation. What a treat.
He was also a philatelist. He was a stamp collector. Mm-hmm. And he found out I was a stamp collector. He bought me a membership in the Philippine Stamp Club.
Well.
He knew we were Jewish. There was no question.
No.
And it was always good evening, Herr Grunke. He was Herr Grunke. Mm-hmm. He wasn't Baron. I found out later he was a Baron.
What was he doing in the Philippines?
In business. He was in some kind of business. There were a lot of Europeans trading. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, it was a good place to trade with China, with Japan, with all the countries that people would travel back and forth. And,
mm-hmm.
I guess his company was headquartered in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
He might have been with a firm like, you know, Siemens or I don't know who he was with. But, Herr Grunke.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, you know, he was really, I was not aware of the horror of the Germans and the things that I've been talking about after World War II.
So after the war. Afterwards.
And I remember one of the...
You're sure, dear.
One of the things I remember that really got me going was a book that Judge reading now, Blessed is the Match.
Oh, Marie Sirkin.
Yes. It was one of the first Holocaust
the very
books.
Very early books.
Very early
book.
It was 1946.
Resistance, yes.
Yes. And, well, if we can get to that later, help us understand what's going on in Europe. But in the Philippines, there was no, other than the Filipino Catholics, who were very anti-Semitic. And partly because, you know, the teaching of the church at that time was the Jews did this terrible thing. And I didn't know what I had done, but it must have been pretty horrible to get beaten up for it regularly. Although I had Christian friends, I had Catholic friends, and my parents had Catholic friends, who were, some of whom were very, very nice, and very kind, and very helpful people who, you know, really helped us out. But there was a strong anti-Semitic thing.
How long did you stay at the school? Yeah.
We stayed in that school until the bombings began, and I guess the bombings began in 44 or 45, and then when Manila was being bombed on a regular interval, it became dangerous to travel because...
So you were taken out of school?
Taken out of school and stayed home.
Were there any other experiences that you had in 43? That you would want to tell us about?
Well, there were two amusing incidents with the English language.
Mm-hmm.
One of which was before the war, I was signed up to go to a school, an English-speaking school, and I was given some kind of an IQ test or something. I remember coming home and saying to my mother that I thought I did something terrible on the test, and she said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, English is a funny language." Anyway, it turns out that there was a question, can a duck ride a horse? Well, I did not know what a D-U-C-K was. I had no idea what this was. So I looked at the word, and I said, this must be the English way of spelling D-U-C, which is duke in French. And of course, dude, that's what dukes do. They get on their horses and they ride around. So I said yes. So probably somewhere there is a record of me as being an absolute imbecile because I think ducks ride horses.
Oh my.
I remember that one. The other one was in Manila, right after the war started. Right, Manila is on a bay, Manila Bay, and around the bay there's a very beautiful drive, which was then called Dewey Boulevard. I don't know what it's called now. And there was a little cafe that had opened up there called The Aristocrat. And they served ice cream. And they had a jukebox. And the jukebox had songs like Potapola on the something, something, something or other. I don't remember them. It was Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Sheen and other great songs of the day. Mersey Doats and things like that. And the Japanese Navy, of course, in Manila is a natural harbor. I was there working, and the Japanese, to me, he was an admiral, and he only went in some sort of,
lots of
brave. Gold and so forth. Yeah. He said to me, in English, do you want some ice cream? And I said, sure. So he bought ice cream, and he was telling me about his children in Japan, and he kept saying, would you like to pray with me? He really meant play. And I thought he wanted to dominate. So I did not understand it. Anyway, that was my experiences at the beginning. At the end, know, there are lots of other stories.
Was your apartment damaged during the bombing?
Well, the first apartment we were in, we were asked to leave by the Japanese. And then we moved two or three times. Each time the Japanese would requisition housing, we moved further and further away from the center of the city, which was divine providence, because, as you know, Manila was destroyed, except for one or two small areas, and we happened to be in one of them.
Mm-hmm.
In one neighborhood,
Santa
Ana.
There are lots of casualties, civilian casualties.
Well, I'll tell you that story, too. We realized that the war was coming to, was winding down or winding up or whatever, that the Japanese had lost. And it got to be kind of hairy. The bombings were going on every day. And we lived with two other families, non-Jewish. No one was Jewish, one was not.
Mm-hmm.
In this very large house, which had been built by the Spaniards, which had walls about a yard thick to keep the house cool. The idea is that with very thick walls, the house could be cool. And it really worked. And the house was subdivided into three apartments. And the house next door was requisitioned by the Japanese, and they had billeted troops there. And we were, this time, it was really getting scary because, you know, what would these troops do to us? And I had one encounter with a drunken Japanese soldier who had his hands around my throat.
Mm.
But he was just drunk. I mean, he was just drunk. Fortunately, I could mutter enough Japanese and his friends, you know, come on, Helena, you don't leave the kid alone. But you know, I was scared. I mean, he was a big guy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what drunk meant, really. I mean, I'd never seen anybody drunk before.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy smelled kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
And his Japanese wasn't very good either. He was slurring it. But then and things had gotten very bad. The Japanese troops no longer had rifles. They had wooden guns. They were drilling with wooden guns.
Mm-hmm.
Things had gotten very bad. One night, we heard lots of movement next door, and we were quite concerned. Trucks pulled up, and they took the soldiers away, and they never were seen again.
Mm.
And soon after that, the city fell. And I remember, you know, we were wondering what was happening. And we could not, all the radios had been confiscated by the Japanese, and then returned, but Fixie could only listen to their stations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I remember one night, my father, we were listening to Radio Manila, which was the voice of the Japanese-controlled government, and they were just playing music. And we knew that you know, MacArthur had landed in Leyte, and that the new leaflets had been dropped and things like that. And when my father gets a phone call, and this man identifies himself and says, "Our friends are here. I can't tell you anymore."
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we knew what this meant, and the next thing we knew, the radio just went off the air.
Mm-hmm.
And it couldn't, there was still electricity. There was still water.
Mm-hmm.
So of course we immediately filled up everything we could with water. We figured the first thing we'd go would be water.
Mm-hmm.
And my father providentially, when the war broke out, you know, spent every cent he could get his hands on. We had canned goods. And bless the American canning industry. We had canned goods that had been 3 years old at the end of the war, and the time we bought them, I don't know how long they were in cans before that, and they were still as good.
They were still good.
Mm. Carnation milk is one of the things I remember.
mm-hmm.
And
how long were you in that state?
Well, about 3 days, two or three days, mm-hmm. and then one day I was looking down the road, and I see some friends of ours coming, looking absolutely bedraggled, you know,
mm-hmm.
dirty, and clothes were ripped, and they looked as if they'd been dragged through, and they were the people who escaped the fighting in the north. And our home became a hostel.
I see.
For almost 2 weeks, where
mm.
people, all, I think half the Jewish community came through.
Mm. Straggling
through, who would escape with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And telling all kinds of horrible stories. But the end was horrible. It was, the city was fought over brick by brick.
Is that so?
Although there was one story again that came out of there. I don't know if the story is true or not, but it's a good story that the Germans took, the Nazi Germans took refuge in the German embassy. And when things got too hot there, they decided to go across the street to another building that seemed safer, and they took out this huge German swastika flag and tried to cross the street with it, and the Japanese just mowed them down.
Mm.
They had no use for any of them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And then in 1945, we were finally liberated.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing the first curious what kinds of things have been cares. The first American soldier with a mezuzah around his neck. They had given all the Jewish soldiers little kits. I still have a prayer book from that kit, which was given by the Jewish War Board or whatever it was. Included in it was a mezuzah, which they wore around their neck. And I remember seeing the first Jewish soldier. And shortly thereafter, it must have been shortly thereafter, because this happened in March, I think, was Pesach. And there were two Jewish chaplains, rabbis, attached to the, it was the 1st Cavalry Division, I guess, or whoever else was there. One of whom, I believe, name was Rabbi Gordon. I don't know his first name. I don't know if he's the famous Rabbi Gordon who one reads about, or somebody else. I don't know. I would love to find out who the rabbis were. And
I guess the chaplain service.
They probably could tell me.
Could tell you, yes.
And they came to our home, and they visited all the Jews, and they brought us things and so forth. And that Passover, they had a seder in the racetrack in Miller, which was the racetrack. It was the largest auditorium. It wasn't covered, but it was, you know,
open large
for the American Army and all the Jewish
civilians
that they could muster. And they sent jeeps out for us and gave us matzah. And we had a seder.
Oh, what a momentous experience that was for them. True liberation. Did you hear anything at all about the Jews who were in Shanghai?
We knew a lot of the Jews who were in Manila. The German Jews had come through Shanghai.
Had come through.
And some had come through Nagasaki, through Japan too. And the ones who, a lot of them had come to Manila thinking it'd be safer than being in Shanghai. It turned out, I don't think it made much, a whole lot of difference. There was no, and I had not heard any horror stories. I had, as I said, I had not heard any horrible anti-Semitic Holocaust, mass destruction and things like that until we came back to this country.
Do you think your parents knew what was happening in Europe?
I suspect. Well, I don't know. I mean,
they may not have.
They may not have. I mean, they knew that terrible things were happening. I don't think anybody knew how terrible they were until when. I don't know.
Camps were liberated.
Well, they knew before. There was a lot of intelligence out before that.
I mean, some people, of course, knew.
Right, but most people wouldn't accept.
So unthinkable. So how long then did you?
We stayed in Manila for about 3-4 months after the liberation. We sailed from Manila just before VE Day. I celebrated VE Day on board a ship between Leyte and Samar, two islands.
You were on your way to the States?
On my way to the States.
Now, did Father by then have a visa number?
No. We came to this country and then we became a little more politically astute at that time, and we kept getting one extension after another. And finally, we got back here. Let's see, the war was over in 45, right? So we got back in 45. It took 5 years before we were accepted with a visa, a permanent visa. We had to leave the country, go to Canada, stay overnight, and come back. I remember being
technical
silliness and having to come back. And then in 1948 or 49 that happened, because I became a citizen the same year I graduated college, in 1954.
So you went to college here?
I went to college in the States. And 54 I became a citizen.
And did your folks hear from any of their relatives in Europe?
Well, when we came back, did you see the play on Shana Madel?
No.
Now, in there, there is a scene which is absolutely so accurate and so heartrending, I just fell apart.
Edith told me about it.
Where the father meets somebody who just come back, and they both pull out their little notebooks and say, Shlibovitz and Slimowitz and this one and that one, and the answer is always dead, 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 murdered. And I remember, you know, when we came back, we had no idea where my father's parents were. We knew they had been alive when we left Belgium, but that was 5 years ago. And that I remember the newspaper publishing lists every day of people that had been found in concentration camps. And my father would spend hours reading through them, looking for names. We never found them out. I suspect my grandparents were murdered. I'm sure they were. And, you know, we heard stories about people whose relatives, not relatives, but friends, distant relatives, who stayed behind and who survived and who didn't. And some of the family went back to Belgium, some of them came back and forth and so forth and so on. And then I began to get an understanding of the absolute horror of what had happened. Now, I had seen the horror of war. But it was in person.
You weren't.
I was not. Personally. I wasn't. Well, we were. We had. I suffered from malnutrition and, you know, vitamin deficiencies and all this other wonderful stuff. But it was never personal. This was war, and this is what happens in war. It's a terrible thing.
And your family was intact.
Right. But the idea that, you know, yes, I've been beaten up for being Jewish, but the idea that all the Jews would be singled out, and, you know, we're going to gas you or do other terrible things. That was a revelation to me when I came to this country. The horror of what happened was just incomprehensible. I mean, I had seen horrible things. I had seen a city destroyed. I had seen people killed. I had seen people killed in horrible ways, but not in that scale. I mean, it's still unthinkable.
Well, thank heavens your family survived, didn't
you? Yeah, we managed to somehow, physically intact, psychologically, I don't know. I've talked to my brothers about this a number of times, and we all feel the psychological scars that just will never go away.
But you're trying to integrate the experience?
Well, I don't know what I'm trying to do with it.
Has it helped to have talked about it this way?
Well, I'm glad I was able to do it. I've tried to do it on my own a few times, too. Well, I should add something else, is that one of the things that happened to me after I came to this country, and after when I got to college, I became an apostate, and you know, I wanted no more to do with any religion, and there couldn't possibly be a God, and things like that.
Because of what you
I suspect partly because of that. I just, you know, I don't want any more of this. Partly was also we had a rabbi in the Assembly Synagogue my parents went to, and I will not name him because he's still alive, who said a few things which I thought were really turned me off to religion in general.
But you're wearing your kippah?
Well, 2 years ago, it'll be 3 years ago now, I was in Israel. And my brother had settled there for 10 years. He just came back. And I did tshuva in Israel.
I see.
And lots of things have happened. Since then. And I've tried to reconcile it. I'm trying to understand in some kind of, I don't want to use the word theological necessarily, but in some kind of terms, and putting this down. And I have two children from the previous marriage, and I hope to be getting married again soon. I will have two more children. I want them to have something. I've tried writing it, I've tried talking it in tape recorder by myself, it hasn't worked. And I found out about the work you were doing, I decided that maybe some good can come out of this.
Had you thought about any help, messages, some philosophical approach that you might want to share with younger people who might be listening to our tapes someday? I don't like to use the word advice. That's so formal and stringent. But just to share some thoughts.
My thoughts, I'm very disturbed at what's happening. I think we have this idea that it cannot happen here, and that's not true. It can happen here. It can happen anywhere. I think from what I've read recently about the Pollard trial, anti-Semitism is not dead in this country, not by a long shot. And I'm not saying anything about whether Pollard was guilty or not guilty, or whether he should or shouldn't have. That's I'm talking about the procedures that were used and so forth.
Yes.
It's still here. It could happen. I think we need to The story of Jonah, which is a very difficult story to understand. But in my own simple ways, I understand it, I think is a crucial message that you can't escape what Hashem wants.
How do you know what he wants?
And you never will find out, because Jonah thought that Nineveh should be destroyed. And the people of Nineveh did teshuva, and then Jonah gets angry at God and says, how dare you do this? And so God plants this gourd, which comes up, and God kills the gourd. And Jonah says, how can you do this? And he says, why are you sorry for the gourd? It's only a plant, whereas here are my people. You want me to destroy them.
Mm.
There's a message in there somewhere about trying to understand all of this. And there's also that line, I think it's in Psalms or Isaiah or both, where Hashem says, my ways are not your ways. So you could try and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
In rational terms, it's not possible. So what would I say to my children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren? You know, I think Lord Acton said it best. All that is necessary for the powers of evil to win is for enough good people to do nothing.
Have you shared some of this thinking with your children?
Some.
They're perhaps not ready.
I don't know if they're ready, and I don't like to force this.
The time may not be right for them. Are they curious about what you went through?
To some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I often get the feeling, you know, people don't want to hear about the Holocaust. They don't want to hear about the war anymore. I still have some problems, like I will not buy German products if I can possibly help it.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of tough in Israel riding in Mercedes cabs. It was very difficult for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, my kids will say things like, you know, I don't want to hear about it, Dad. You know, I know what you went through, and, you know, that was 50 years ago, or 100 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, depending on how badly they want to tease me at the time. And it's not relevant today.
There will come a time, and so we'd like to make copies of this testimony and send duplicate tapes to you.
I'd appreciate that.
And one day there may come a moment when they'll want to hear what happened.
I hope so. I'd like to see some good come out of all of this.
This has happened so often in our experience of listening to survivors, that for years and years and years, children simply turn away, and then we'll get a call, please send me a duplicate of my testimony. Something happened, and my kid wants to know what I went through. We've even had American soldiers, American-born soldiers who liberated camps, who never talked about what they went through, what they saw. And they're grown children now, 30, 35 years of age, want to know, and of course are amazed. So we may very well come at time.
You know, it's odd that you mentioned it about 15 years ago. I got a phone call from a woman. The last name was Friedman. I don't remember her first name. Saying she was writing a book about children's experiences during the Holocaust, and could she interview me? And mm-hmm. I said, well, how did you get my name?
And Helen Epstein, by any
no,
chance?
No, no. Was her last name was Friedman.
Oh, Friedman.
And the book was published. It's called Escape or Die.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how did you find me? You know, I'm not talking about this. And mm-hmm. she said, well, you know, your name was mentioned by, I'm a friend of your aunt, and I really would like to come and interview you. And I resisted for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I finally said, all right, you can come and interview me, but I'm not going to let you publish any of this. And she did come, and she interviewed me. It was very, very difficult. And I agreed that she could publish it, but that she would have to use a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
So you've seen that, John.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's even I did not want to, I guess, face it.
It's understandable. Yes. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John.